My name is Luther Peterson, and I'm a parish pastor from Minneapolis, small parish in the near north side, a community which is made up of people who have don't have too much of this world's goods. Most of the people who lived there in previous years have moved to the suburbs, and we have now folks that are besieged with many kinds of problems, broken families, lots of racial mixture, and folks that are very difficult to reach in lots of ways. The parish was a larger one, but now we have like about 450 members, where there used to be about 2,000. I came there a year ago, and we're having a very interesting challenge and interesting time as we approach the needs of some people and the very difficult situation of reconciling the folks that are looking for the good old days again and those who are attempting to meet the real needs of folks in that situation. The parables we're on this week, parables of Luke. Today we're going to talk about the parable of the rich fool. We're going to study that. This is part of a two-week series on the Gospel of Luke, especially as viewed from the underside, as we call it, from the viewpoint of those who have less, who are the disadvantaged. Part of what we talk about comes from the viewpoint of South American liberation theology. It's a kind of theology which has risen up in the midst of poverty in South America. It has a number of spokesmen from various countries, and basically the background of that is that Roman Catholic Church, even though it was once identified with the powerful, is in many cases saying to the powerful, we are going to take another look at this whole thing and try to look at the Bible again and see where the real needs are, and this is causing a great deal of conflict in the church in South America and between the church and government. And they have some interesting things to say to us too as they take another look at Scripture and we see it from a little different viewpoint. Let's begin with a word of prayer. Lord, open our minds and our hearts and our eyes and our ears again this morning to hear some and see some new things. To discover some things about ourselves as well as about others, to deal with our own insecurities, and to discover again how you see this whole picture. In Jesus' name we pray, amen. Perhaps you've heard the story about the three bears. I'm going to tell you a little different version this morning. Three bears were walking in the woods before breakfast. And when they got home, Papa Bear took a look at the table and he growled, "Who's eating all my porridge?" And Baby Bear looked at his bowl and he said, "Who's eating all my porridge?" And Mama Bear took a look at them and said, "Stop griping. I haven't even dished up your porridge yet." You might say they were afraid that they weren't going to get enough. They felt insecure. They had enough. They had plenty. And their needs were being met, but they were nervous about the whole situation. Now, to Mama Bear, the situation of the other two seemed kind of silly, but to them it was real. Well, this kind of poses a question for all of us. How much of our concern is ridiculous? Our concern about our security and whether we have enough is ridiculous. And how much of it is warranted? How much do I need? And some of you were here last week when there was a session in a forum on this, and that came at this from a very good, interesting, practical point of view. We're going to look at it from the standpoint of this parable mainly today, and so for those of you who were here then, I would think that this is going to get at this in a little bit different way, even though it's basically the same topic. all kinds of questions, like how secure is Social Security, how secure is my bank account, and if I were to have the opportunity to inherit some money, and then somebody else in the family chipped me out of it, you know, how much would it take for me to sue them? You know, would it break up our family? Those kinds of questions, which lead into the text itself today, and I'd like to have someone read then. Luke 12, 13 to 21.
One of the multitude said to him, "Teacher, bid my brother divide inheritance with me." But he said to him, "Man, who made me a judge or divider over you?" And he said to them, "Take heed and beware of all covetousness, for a man's life does not consist in the abundance of his possessions." And he told them a parable, saying, "The land of a rich man brought forth plentifully. And he thought to himself, 'What shall I do? For I have nowhere to store my crops.' And he said, 'I will do this. I will pull down my barns and build larger ones. And there I will store all my grain and my goods. And I will say to my soul, soul, you have ample goods laid up for many years. Take your ease, eat, drink, be merry.' But God said to him, 'Fool, this night your soul is required of you. And the things you have prepared, whose will they be?' So is he who lays up treasure for himself and is not rich towards God."
Thank you. Very well. This first part of it talks about one of the commandments. You've all heard of the Ten Commandments. In verse 15, one of the commandments is mentioned. Which one is it? Or two? Or three? Covet. It's that word covetousness, isn't it? What's wrong with coveting? Is there anything wrong with coveting? I mean, what is wrong with it? What does it do to you?
Steal.
Jealous?
Dissatisfied.
Not satisfied?
Selfish? Unhappy,
yes.
Envious?
It's just a nasty kind of thing, isn't it? And really hurts us. It's not only one of the things that God commands us not to do, be covetous, but it can really hurt us. So verse 15 is a key verse here. Jesus says, "Take heed and beware of all covetousness." That's how he answers the fellow. Poor fellow that comes up just wants to have Jesus help him out. He says, "Beware of all covetousness, for a man's life does not consist in the abundance of his possessions." This is a direct warning that Jesus gives in regard to covetousness and greed. Take heed, beware. Those are strong words. Decisive emphasis here on the sin of greed. And then the last half of verse 15, if you'll notice, would somebody read again the last half of verse 15?
"For a man's life does not consist in the abundance of his possessions."
Oh, yes. What is that saying? How would you say that in some other words?
That isn't the whole of life. Your possessions is not your life.
It's not that important. You've heard a person ask, what's she worth? Or what's he worth? What are they asking? How much money do they have? As though that were the sum total of one's value, right? Jesus is saying that isn't how you measure somebody's value. It isn't how you measure your own value or anybody else's. Regardless of how many people talk that way, it still isn't true. And to think so is to be a fool in the ultimate sense of the word. That is, one who is ignorant of the true meaning of life and its origins in God. Well, this is a dispute over the inheritance. I don't suppose any of you have ever had a problem or known anybody who had a problem with a dispute over inheritance. No, that's one of the most common things that breaks up families and causes brothers and sisters to become enemies. And we see it all the time, and it's as old as this and earlier, and it's going to, I suppose, go on for a long time. According to the Old Testament law, I don't know if you know what the Old Testament law was in regard to this, the oldest son always inherited the land, if it was a family that had some land. And then also the oldest son was supposed to inherit a double portion of the other possessions. But the rest of the family got something. It was divided among the younger brothers. That is, brothers, yeah, not sisters, but brothers. All right, in this case, Jesus is invited to mediate a dispute. And apparently the younger brother isn't getting even what he's supposed to get. somehow the older brother has found a way to get more than the law says he's supposed to get. Yes?
Are you really using the word brother in the true sense, or is it meaning family member?
Yeah, this is really a family situation here.
So it is brothers,
yeah,
that you're referring to now.
Right, this older, younger brother. And the younger brother is angry because his older brother has some way found a way to twist the law or to change things so that he isn't getting even what he's supposed to get. And he comes to Jesus, but Jesus refuses to get involved. Now, the fact that Jesus was asked to mediate this dispute really isn't too surprising, because rabbis were normally looked upon as persons who were wise. One of their roles was to act as mediators, or especially interpreters of the law, the Old Testament law, so that people would get justice. And Jesus was also popular, as you know, at this point at least. And he enjoyed the favor of those who were being taken advantage of. Okay, what is surprising, so it's not surprising that they asked him, but what's surprising is that Jesus refused to get involved. Why do you suppose he refused to get involved? Anybody?
Didn't think it was important.
Didn't think it was important? Okay. Any other ideas on that?
He had a business.
I didn't hear those.
That was not his main concern.
It wasn't his main concern? Okay.
He had a lesson he wanted to teach.
Oh, very good thoughts here. Any others?
He probably didn't want to pass judgment on either one.
Okay.
Would that be something that the courts would take care of?
I'm not sure if there was another court. I suppose, yeah, he would have. There would have been another way for him to get recourse to justice there. Hopefully.
Maybe he wanted to pass judgment on both of them.
All right. All kinds of possibilities here. Some have thought that the reason he didn't want to act as a mediator here because he wasn't an official rabbi. Didn't have the title officially given to him. He was a self-appointed rabbi, as you know. But also, I'm sure you're aware of the fact that Jesus spoke out very strongly on a lot of other issues, even though he wasn't an official rabbi. So I very much doubt that this would have stopped him at this point. Other people suggest that, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Doesn't he make it clear several times that God is the judge? That he is not, and God is the judge?
That God is the final judge, uh-huh. Always pointing to a higher authority. That's a good thought, too. Yeah. Well, some people also have the idea that Jesus wouldn't want to bother with such mundane issues as possessions or money. But on the other hand, Jesus was very... That can't be right either, because Jesus was very down to earth and talked about some pretty down to earth kinds of things, related the faith to very much of a worldly sort of an approach. That is, the world and money and goods and property. Jesus talked about them all the time. So why doesn't he get involved then?
It seems like he's saying you don't need an abundance. That would say.
You just need enough. Right. Okay, and yeah, that's right. And it goes back to verse 15 again then, doesn't it? Because that's kind of what he's saying there. That's an illustration. He's using this as an illustration of how greed and covetousness can divide families and it can hurt us. Also, and this is just saying what you've already said in a little different way, you've come up with some very fine answers here, that no mediation of one dispute is going to solve the deeper problem of greed and covetousness that's in all of us. So Jesus avoids getting caught in a surface issue and instead goes to the heart of the matter. This talks about covetousness and the false evaluation of human life in economic terms. The questions like this question of the younger brother expose the greed in us, you see, and obscure the question. They really obscure the question of what human life is finally all about. A man's life is what? Does it say? Okay, just to repeat that again. A man's life does not consist in the abundance of his possessions. Right. Okay, and so that's the introduction, man. This is the scene. This is the situation that leads up to the telling of this parable. Before we actually go into the parable, Dave, do you have any more comments on that situation? The father, the two brothers, and Jesus dealing with them in this kind of a way. Any other comments?
In most of his parables, he puts forth the facts and lets the people make their own decisions.
Okay.
He's really telling them they don't need a judge if they'll just stop and think.
All right. They won't need a judge if they just stop and think. They don't have to go to court over everything. Lawsuits all the time. Of course, that's our society nowadays, isn't it?
If
lawsuit happy. All right, say that again.
If he really loved his brother, he wouldn't covet his possessions.
Yeah, okay. So, in other words, this would be a kind of a way of saying that his love for his brother was falling short of what it should have been. That something like possessions could just get right in the way. Okay, any other thoughts about this introductory? Yeah.
Yeah, I have a little trouble with it.
Okay, good. Let's hear it, Roxy.
I think that younger brother should have gotten his rightful inheritance.
All right. You think Jesus should have stepped in and helped him?
No, not necessarily. I mean, I think the older brother should not have been so greedy and given the younger brother his rightful inheritance.
Okay, that does.
And that's why I have trouble with it.
That does. That Jesus got kind of theoretical here, you mean, instead of getting at the issue.
Yeah, he didn't actually take care of the problem.
Yeah, how about that?
So it makes me wonder how they did take care of the problem.
Good question. Good thought. Yeah. Okay, over here.
He may have thought that he couldn't help the older brother and he seemed a possibility in the younger one.
Maybe. Okay, that maybe this guy could get helped, or else maybe the older brother was standing beside him, which I doubt.
But the older brother is the one that needed the help.
Yeah, the older one needed the help badly.
Yeah.
Okay, any other comments here? Anybody that wants to address Roxy's question here, though, that's a dilemma.
We don't know what the condition the younger brother was in. He might have been pretty affluent even with what he got.
Possibly.
But that still doesn't make it.
He's a rich man, so he might have been pretty affluent anyway, so why did he need some more? This is where the covetousness comes in.
Possibility.
If we see someone doing wrong, should we let him continue doing wrong, or should we make him face the fact that he is doing wrong?
Okay.
He's worried about the wrong because of the effect of him.
Yeah, I know.
Okay, let's try to talk one at a time here. Over there and then back to Bill.
To her question about the younger brother, you're saying that it was not evenly divided?
No, I'm saying that if he didn't get the rightful, lawful inheritance, that there is a problem, and...
But look today, how many of our families today, if you are aware of it, that they divide their inheritance and only one maybe will get it because of a little bit of a grudge between them, or their individual has felt that this one particular person showed them more interest and love and benefits during the year, so that individual got it, whereas the next member of the family is left out.
A playing favorites kind of thing.
That's
where a parent
right.
gets sucked into playing favorites. Mm-hmm. All right? It's a dilemma, Bill.
Well, it seems to me that the younger brother that's talking to Jesus is only asking for justice.
Sure sounds like it.
But then Jesus is saying there may be things more important than justice.
Something more important than justice. Okay.
We're not told that he's asking for justice.
Yeah, that's right. That's right.
We
don't know.
We're not told that at all. It may be his selfish desire.
Okay, it's a little bit of a dilemma there. Let's take a couple more comments and we'll go on to the parable.
We must remember at that time of the society, the older brother always inherited.
Yes.
And we have to remember that as we discuss this.
Yeah, he was supposed to get all the land and a double portion, but the younger brother was supposed to get part of it, though.
Yes.
Yeah, and apparently he wasn't getting as much as he was supposed to, or at least that's the way it looks anyway. Yeah, let's just take these two, and then we better go on to the next.
Maybe they both should remember you can't take it with you.
Yeah. Okay. That's kind of what he was saying. All right.
Towards the older brother.
Yeah, maybe he was good around the corner or something. And we wanted, maybe he was going to overhear this too. Well, that's possible. I got to let my wife talk. She wants the last word.
No. aren't we always in the situation of being able to look at someone else who has gotten more than we got and feeling that, why is that just? Why is it just that we, as the older brothers in the world, supposedly as far as the most favored, are getting all the cars and the machines and the food when our brothers in South America are not?
Okay. All right. So that's another angle, another kind of a way of coming at it there. Well, let's go on to the parable. Thank you. That's good discussion, good insights here. And we'll come back if we have more time. We can come back to this again, too. But this is quite a juicy parable, so we want to get on to it. Okay, let's take a look at that rich farmer. What kind of a situation was he in as we stop to think about this? A wealthy landowner in first century Palestine, of which there were some. And he lives from the labor of others. He hires people to work for him. He may not have acquired his property unjustly. He may have. We don't know, this rich farmer, the rich fool, as we call him. We're moving on now to the parable itself, not the two brothers. Anyway, he had a bumper crop that year, and so he has to decide what to do, and he decides to store the crops as a security for early retirement or for some reason. Maybe he just wanted to store the crops until the price jumped higher, to make a little more profit on it. All of these things are within the realm of normal procedure, very likely. And then it says in verse 19, would one of you read verse 19 again?
And I will say to my soul, soul, you have ample goods laid up for many years. Take your ease, eat, drink, be merry.
Okay, now that phrase has often been looked upon by people as negative, as a wicked way of talking, but it was a common phrase. It was a common way of putting, let's simply enjoy positively the things that I have. In those days, it was not a bad thing to say, like so often we say nowadays. It does not necessarily imply moral dissipation. This is just a common proverb, actually, is what it is. It's the good life, doing what he wanted to. He worked hard. Yes. Oh, I thought you were raising your hand. I'm sorry. Anyway, he worked hard, and he felt that this would be a good way to handle the situation. Okay. The verdict that God pronounces, however, at this point, read verse 20 again, would you please?
But God said to him, fool, this night your soul is required of you.
Okay, thank you. What's a fool?
Someone who's not wise.
Okay, someone who doesn't have good judgment, someone who's not wise. What was it you were saying? Oh. All right, that's okay. Doesn't use common sense. A couple other quick definitions of fool.
Frivolous.
Frivolous? Any others?
Wasteful.
Wasteful? Anybody remember back in the Old Testament, something from the Psalms, where the psalmist defines a fool?
Fool has said in his heart, there is no God.
That's right. That's exactly the one I was fishing for here. Fool is one who lives as though there were no God, at least. He may talk about God and confess the creed, and he just doesn't live as though there were any God. He's really accountable. He assumes that he's accountable to nobody but himself. I'm sure that none of you are that way or know anybody that's that way, but that's what a fool is, they say. Do you think that the rich and the powerful might be more tempted and often trapped by this illusion than others who are less well-to-do?
Yeah.
It's very possible. So this parable seeks to shatter the seductive hold that this can have on people. And it's something that's so evident, of course, in the life of this landowner. The rich man does not take God into account. He fails to see the reality of death hanging over his head. The hour of death becomes the shattering moment of accountability. At least this is the way that this parable has usually been interpreted. Now he's face to face with the fact that he has lived chiefly for himself. and that he has worshipped and served what God?
Mammon.
Mammon, yes. His whole life has been built upon a lie. It was his possessions that deceived him, that seduced him. And the final indictment, verses 20 and 21. Would somebody read that again?
But God said to him, "Fool, this night your soul is required of you, and the things you have prepared, whose will they be? So is he who lays up treasure for himself and is not rich toward God."
Okay, thank you. Now, how would you summarize what was wrong with this fellow? In just plain ordinary
comments. He placed his heart on material things.
Okay. He placed his heart, his trust in material things. All right? Just a few other quick.
And then he says, whose will they be? So that should be a concern to him.
Yeah, who's. Can't take it with you. You're not going to enjoy him yourself. Okay? A few other things that were wrong with this guy.
Get the feeling he wasn't tithing or whatever he should have been doing with his goods either.
Might not have been tithing or sharing like he should have been. Okay.
He was greedy. He wanted more.
Greedy. He wanted more. All right. His stewardship was kind of rotten. He was greedy. He wanted more. Any other things that were wrong with him?
Completely selfish.
Selfish.
Just for himself.
Just for himself, Bill.
Well, I'm not sure that I hear all of that in there. He had more. Already. It doesn't say he was in any way dissatisfied with what he had.
He already had it. Okay.
And he was just going to take care of it.
That's an interesting little insight there. Yeah. Okay. Good.
He is not rich toward God.
Yeah.
Not rich toward God. That's something that was wrong with him. What does that mean, you suppose?
His possessions came before his love of God.
Okay, his possessions came before his love of God. I'd like to just stop on that one for a second. How else would you describe what it means to be not rich toward God? Not rich toward God. Think about that. We got one definition over here. Any others?
Of course, he wasn't aware of the blessings that he was missing out on either.
Okay, he wasn't aware of what it would be like to be able to share and live that way. Okay, further.
Well, loving your neighbor, that's the second commandment.
Okay, he missed out on
that. Instead of sharing, he's going to build bigger, he's going to hoard that all for himself.
Okay, so to be not rich toward God means that he missed out on loving his neighbor. That's a good insight. Further, yeah.
Well, he hadn't laid any treasures up in heaven.
Okay, that's the other way of putting that, isn't it? Didn't lay up treasures in heaven. Okay, do you suppose he was separated from anybody, like from God, and maybe from his fellow men. Yeah, we're on the parable now, but I probably didn't make that clear enough. We jumped from the story about the two brothers to the parable. We're talking about the rich fool now. So, but that's true. That certainly affected. That was the two brothers is an example, isn't it, of how possession separates. And so one of them got loaded and the other one got jealous, and that's they're very tied together. So thank you for mentioning that too. Okay, any other things that were wrong with him? Yes, Ruth.
I keep coming back to devotions at breakfast where he talked about Dorothy Day and Mother Teresa giving till it hurts or loving until it hurts. And then discovering what real more love, yes. And I wonder if this is what it means to be rich toward God.
Okay. That was a beautiful.
That greater love, yeah. That's beyond our comprehension, or that greater riches that's beyond our comprehension.
Yeah, yeah. That one quote by Mother Teresa. Say that. Do you remember the quote exactly again? Does anybody remember the quote from Mother Teresa?
Give till it hurts and then it doesn't hurt anymore.
That's right.
And then there's something about love again that comes.
Love till it hurts.
Yeah. Love till it hurts.
Love till it hurts, and then
it doesn't hurt anymore.
Doesn't hurt anymore. And then something about love comes in again too.
Yes. It was a greater love than you ever had before.
Yeah, it was a neat way of putting it. Another thing that was wrong with this guy, do you suppose he really cared about anybody else but himself?
Well, I think that the tying it together with the beginning of it, where the problem was a man's life does not consist of the abundance of his possessions. Apparently, his life did consist of the abundance of his possessions.
Yeah, Yeah, here's an example, folks. Here's an example of somebody whose life did consist in the abundance of his possessions. Very nice way to put it. Very well put.
You could call him a miser then.
Yeah, yeah, you could call him that. Over here.
Could it be pride? He didn't think he needed God?
Pride, his own self-sufficiency, didn't need God, right? And he didn't care. He didn't really care about some other people. And that was his destruction, wasn't it? That's what just finally ate him up. And I wanted to say those words to just so I could fit in a little story. You know, I like to do that once in a while. The story of a little boy by the name of Pierre who didn't care. He had one sentence. His only one sentence he really knew how to say. I don't care. Every time his mother told him, eat your vegetables, Pierre would always say, Every time his mother would say, Pierre, you eat your vegetables or you won't grow up to be big and strong. And Pierre would say, I don't care. Or his dad would say, you get to bed now, Pierre, or you will be tired in school tomorrow. And Pierre would say, I don't care. Or his mother would say, you put your jacket on or you're going to catch pneumonia. And he'd say, I don't care. And one day, Pierre was home all alone, and a lion came to the door. And Pierre opened the door, and the lion said, I'm going to come in and eat you up. And Pierre said, I don't care. And a little later on, his mother came home, and there she saw this lion sitting there. And she asked, where's Pierre? And the lion said, I don't care. Well, that's kind of goofy, but anyway, his not caring is what caused him to be consumed or eaten up. You stretch that one far enough to apply it to a situation like that. Better for a children's sermon, but I guess we all like to hear children's stories. What's the main message of this parable for us, if you were to summarize it just in a sentence? Anybody?
Get your priorities right.
Get your priorities straight. All right? Any other way of putting it?
Somebody put in a word of defense for this guy, this poor rich fool.
Okay, let's...
I don't want to, I'm not going to.
Oh.
But we made him sound like a real evil, horrible type of person. And like you implied at the very start of this Bible study, maybe some of us, maybe a lot of us, not just in this country, but all around the world, are a little bit like this guy.
Okay. Jesus didn't paint him as being a villain with a sword in his hand or a dagger or with all the looks of a villain on television or on movies like Jim can tell us about. Roxy?
I interpret the word fool as to mean somebody who just isn't quite with it. A sinful person, a person going in the wrong direction, not somebody that deliberately is out to, you know, to be possessed by the devil and go after God that way or something. You know, I don't think of a fool as that way. I just think of somebody is just, he's just going in the wrong direction.
Yeah.
Only okay. Got caught.
Okay.
I think you could be happy.
All right.
Be happy and thankful with what you have because you could have less.
Okay, be happy, thankful. This is the flip side of covetousness, isn't it? That's an important thing for us to realize, especially as we look at the commandments. You know, what does this mean? We are to be grateful and thankful. Okay?
It seems like, you know, we work toward getting retirement and stuff like this. It seems like this is what he wants to do, is get everything ready so he has enough to live on to enjoy life.
Okay.
When he retires.
Do you suppose Jesus is telling this parable in such a way as a lot of us might just identify with this guy?
Yeah.
He's not bad, not a bad guy. He isn't the bad man. He's frugal. He's working hard to get his stuff together. I'm going to tell you a little story in a little while, which will kind of give us, another look at that, like you're talking about, to help us to see how this fella just looks like an awful lot of very fine people that we are or that we know, and Jesus, then he comes at it, you know, with a little twist at the end to see that, well, this guy has just got some little thing, a little flaw in his character, like the tragedies of Shakespeare and the Greek tragedies, and somehow that just destroys a very nice thing otherwise. Okay. Yeah, okay.
It seems to me that there's some real subtleties at play here in the parable, in that because of the fact that God wants us to be satisfied with what we have to be careful, and I was talking with a person about this the other day, we have to be careful that we don't use that as an excuse to accept mediocrity.
Okay.
And not to push ourselves, but to maximize the things that we have. Because, I'll just leave it at that. Somebody else may want to comment.
That's right. Now, that's a good counterpoint here, a good thing to kind of bring in at this point, because it could be used as an excuse for laziness, too. And that, you know, certainly Jesus isn't teaching that, but it could be used as a cop-out, a person wanted to do that. Okay, good point. Over here.
On the other hand, there are many who have great wealth who have been willing to share it generously with the Christian work in the world.
Mm-hmm.
And they have felt then that they are earning in order to be able to share. They have been given the talents to accumulate possessions, but they also have the wisdom to share.
Right. Okay, and that's like Zacchaeus here, wasn't it? Last week, some of you were here last week, we talked about Zacchaeus as the model of how a rich man can, in fact, respond in a positive way. Give away half my goods to the poor. If I've defrauded anybody, I'm going to make it up for them fourfold. And Jesus says, today salvation has come to this man. And this is kind of the concluding episode in the Gospel of Luke, where Jesus has been dealing all earlier. This parable comes earlier too, you see. Jesus has been asking the question, can a rich man get into heaven? Can a rich person be saved? He's raising this dilemma all the way through, and then he comes with Zacchaeus, and he puts his blessing over Zacchaeus, because here's a rich man who has known how to do it. And that's kind of what you're saying, isn't it? It is possible, and here's how. Okay.
Well, now, when he's talking to his soul, that's a little different, I think. Maybe this is to point out to us that when we think we've really made it, maybe we haven't.
Oh, that's interesting. When he's talking to his soul, yeah, that I like the way you said that. He's talking to himself, in other words.
We think we have.
Yeah, he's having a little
we've got it made.
Yeah, he's having a little conversation with himself, and he feels kind of satisfied. Would you say that again? Say a little bit more about that.
Well, he's depending on himself instead of God.
Okay. All right,
he has done it.
He's having a little prayer with himself.
Oh, here I am.
Instead of with God, I'd say. Okay, good. Very good, thank you. One over here.
This sort of goes along with what she said, that this man and also we in our retirement failed to remember that God has promised to take care of our needs if we ask Him, and that He watches the sparrow. And if he takes care of them, he'll take care of us. If we...
Okay, and that's good. That's very closely tied in, because Jesus goes on in the rest of the chapter and quotes some of those very same things that you're talking about. I tell you, do not be anxious about your life, what you shall eat, what you shall drink. It's the same kind of thing that he says in the Sermon on the Mount in Matthew, and talking about the sparrow. This is very closely tied in with what we're talking about here. Yes.
I don't agree completely with that attitude, because God also gave us our minds and our wisdom, and He wants us to manage for ourselves. Mm-hmm. Not to be selfish,
sure.
But we're to manage for ourselves. So I don't think planning for retirement is wrong.
No, no.
We don't want to be a burden. You know, we shouldn't set ourselves up to be a burden. We should set ourselves up to manage ourselves, manage with our family.
That's right.
And our neighbors.
Okay. Maybe we do need to talk to ourselves a little bit at that point. Yeah, and it's kind of what she was saying back there too, that we do need to manage carefully. It isn't that he's against here so much as a basic selfish attitude. And I don't think that Jesus' main point here is that it's fun to criticize the rich. So let's have a little criticism session. Yeah, go ahead.
I didn't mean to interrupt.
No, it's fine.
It seemed to me that Jesus was telling this man that he already had enough. That he didn't have to worry about the balance, that he should be doing something good with that rather than just storing it up for himself.
Okay. He was trying to help him be satisfied and not covetous, because he does use the word covetous here, the person who needs to, he needs to come to a point earlier in his life maybe, or else share it, so he feels comfortable with having less. Okay, lots of different angles here. Roxy?
It seems to me this is a sin of omission instead of commission. It's not
okay.
What he did, but what he didn't do.
Sins of omission. Excellent, yes. Person that could say, very law-abiding, mm-hmm. frugal, good citizen, but some sins of omission. Excuse me, one over here that I didn't quite catch.
Let me muddy the water a little further.
Good.
In verses 32-33, fear not, little flock, for it is your Father's good pleasure to give you the kingdom. Sell your possessions and give alms. Provide yourselves with purses that do not grow old, with a treasure in the heaven that does not fail, where no thief approaches, no moth destroys. For where your treasure is, there will your heart be also.
Okay.
Now, how many of us are going out to sell all our stuff and give the money away next week?
That's one of the tough sayings of Jesus here. That anybody got a quick answer to that one?
Well, he doesn't say sell all your possessions, as we just said here. St. Francis did that.
Yeah.
As we heard the other night.
Okay. Yeah, let me just make a quick comment on that, not to make it easier or to rationalize it, but the evidence from early Christianity and the early Christian church, especially as we study the book of Acts, to see how they really lived this out in the early church, was not that he was asking all people from then on, whoever followed him, to become a Saint Francis. If they wanted to do that, that's certainly their thing, and that's okay. But and he did require of his twelve disciples that kind of a commitment, it seems. But from beyond that, in the early church, it was more getting together, pooling at least most of their possessions, making sure nobody was going without. And Acts 2 and Acts 4, which were also written by Luke, give us some pretty good pictures of the early Christian community to see how the, you know, how that sharing took place.
But in living up the capital, there would come a day when they'd all be destitute. And one of the reasons, perhaps, that they were doing this, they thought that the end of this world was coming.
True.
Yeah. Why worry about the
right.
next year or
that's
your
true
children
too.
Or
that's
your
right.
grandchildren, because he's going to be around that long.
Okay, very good point. This is the perspective that many that they had. The kingdom was going to come, and this thing was going to end, and the end of the world was coming, and so that is that can be used as a cop out for us nowadays, though. To say, well, we know it's not going to happen that way, so we better get all we can. It's a really a difficult thing to nail down. Roxy?
I know a better cop out, and that is that the amount of good that a rich person can do in this world is a tremendous amount. Even though there are a lot of Mother Teresa's around, but there are people who do give up everything and go and help and work with mm-hmm. the poor. But a rich person whose talent is in making money, if they take that money and use it, boy, they can do a
yes,
whole lot.
Yes, that's very good. That's well put, yeah. Each of us has to kind of struggle with where we're at on this.
That's
Nobody can give us a clear answer. I don't want anybody going home with these heavy guilt trips and saying, all I've got is just a bad feeling from this kind of a study. I like to send you home do a little struggling, but I don't mean that I want you to...
But he's just pointed
yeah.
at all of us, because we really, when you think of it, we all have more than we need.
Okay.
What are we doing with that?
And the world is coming to an end. You see, he said in this parable,
oh.
tonight your soul is demanded of you.
Uh-huh.
For each of us.
You don't know when.
We don't know when. Okay. One more comment over here, and then I want to get on to some comments from people in Latin America. We'll take two here, two or three, but that's
well,
all.
Well, Liz is something in point that even though we don't have a great deal, a lot of us do share, or want to share,
Yesterday we went to Stehegan, and the young man got left on the dock because he didn't have enough money to pay his fare.
Oh.
And we found out that after the boat was in the water, well, everybody that we talked to, if we'd only known, we would have paid his fare.
Oh, yeah,
yeah.
Sure. Yeah, it made you feel bad.
We are all supposed to be stewards of all of God's goods. We really don't own what we have.
It belongs to God, the whole concept of stewardship. I think I caught one more voice trying to break in back here a while ago, and then we'll... Or did that person hear it said by somebody else? Okay, we'll go on. We have about almost 15 minutes here we could use. These are comments again. As many of you know, I always like to share a few comments by some folks in the back country of Nicaragua. They get together and they discuss these Bible passages, and they say some pretty harsh things. So brace yourself again. These are some people who meet with their priest, and they discuss this passage about the two guys that, first of all, the two guys that were supposed to divide inheritance. This is what they're discussing first, when the younger brother comes to Jesus to want Jesus to be a mediator in this inheritance. The priest says, "Did Jesus do badly by not wanting to do justice between these two?" William says, "He didn't come to distribute the riches. It's up to society to do that. And the sharing ought to be done among everybody, not just between two. They left the rest out. They asked him to sanction private property, the inheritance laws, the status quo. He refuses. He hasn't come for that." Floriano says, "He didn't come to divide up wealth, to create capital. Many people think religion is for that, to defend their private property, their inheritances. It seems to me in a Christian society, that's to say in a socialist or communist society, there shouldn't be any inheritance." Oscar says, "That man was asking for money, which was going to isolate him from the other brothers and sisters." The priest says, "Jesus apparently wants nothing to do with the rich, not even to do justice among them, because he knows that among them everything is injustice, and he rejects their system totally. He hasn't come to earth to divide inheritance, because who said that inheritors have a right to receive their inheritance? He says that Jesus was just, and that's why he wants to set him up as a judge. But he didn't know that Jesus' justice was another kind of justice, revolutionary justice. Even now there are Christians who think that Christ's justice is the justice of capitalism. The military junta in Chile says it's restoring Christianity because it's restoring private property." The priest says, "According to Jesus, it's not just happiness that's at stake. It's life itself that doesn't depend on what one may have." Floriano says, "As I understand it, Jesus says that having riches isn't living. It's being isolated. It's death." Olivia says, "He shows that riches are the same as greed. The richer you are, the greedier you have to be." Donald says, "Instead of abandoning the system, the younger brother wants to be another greedy man. Or he's already become one. They'd be two greedy men fighting over an inheritance." Okay, all of that so far is a discussion of the two brothers who are fighting over the inheritance. Then here's just a couple more comments that are about the parable. Lodiano says, "No doubt about it, those who store up riches when there's so many people to share with are already damned. They're damned for storing things up." Olivia says, "The rich are very unfortunate in the eyes of God, because the richer a man is, the more he has exploited people. And then he owes all that money, that sweat that he's stolen from the worker. Neither of the two had a right to that inheritance. All of it was the people's money, just as it was everybody's wealth that man wanted to store in his barns." Okay, that's pretty hard, pretty harsh stuff. So before you explode, let me just go on to another thing which I want to share with you before we get done. And if we have any time, we'll discuss it after that. And that's something about Clarence Jordan. I'm sure many of you are familiar with Clarence Jordan, a person who did a lot of writing and translating in the language that he felt would be modern, up-to-date, the way Jesus would say it today. And he lived in the South. And Cotton Patch version of Luke, Cotton Patch version of various things. And this little book, if I'd known it was in existence, I would have gotten it in the bookstore and we could have gotten copies of it. It's in the library. It's called Cotton Patch Parables of Liberation. And he translates. His translation of the parable is pretty subtle and interesting. So I'd like to have you just listen carefully to how he translates this parable. He says, one day there was a big crowd of people that were following Jesus. And someone shouted, "Hey, mister, how about making my brother divide up the inheritance with me?" Jesus turned to him and said, "Say, fellow, has anyone appointed me to be an umpire over your financial squabbles?" Then he said to the crowd, "You all really stay on your guard and watch out for all kinds of greediness, because just being rich can't make a man out of you." Then he told them a story that today may have gone something like this. The fields of a certain rich man produced abundantly. We don't know the name of this man, so we'll just call him Sam. Some of us might even want to call him Uncle. Uncle Sam's fields produced an abundance of corn, cotton, peanuts, and soybeans. He had been working on these fields for a long time. He bought them when he and his wife were young. They had worked hard. Many a time they had gone out at the crack of day to do the chores. They spent long days plowing, hoeing cotton, trying to make a big crop so as to pay off the mortgage, buy furniture, get a new car, put the kids through school. Sometimes they even found time to go to church on Sunday. There were times at the close of the day when he and his wife would walk out on the hill back of the house and watch the sun paint its beautiful farewell to the day. They would stand there silently and watch it, and sometimes she would hold his hand and say, "It's pretty, ain't it?" And he would say, "It's pretty, honey. It sure is. It's real pretty." He even found time to hunt arrowheads with his kids, to stalk with them the elusive whippoorwill, and there were times when he would gather them on his lap and read to them from Winnie the Pooh. As time went on, these occasions became rarer. The county agent was there to talk with him about liming his land, contouring, strip farming, soil building, legumes, and all that kind of stuff to make his farm more productive. And there was the stream of machinery salesmen besieging him with all kinds of labor-saving and profit-making equipment. Increasingly, Uncle Sam became more like the machines that dominated his life. He had little feeling anymore. But what did it matter? He was more productive, and better than that, he was making a profit. Long ago, his little corn cribs had given way to row on row of steel grain bins. His barns now were bulging warehouses. His problem now was not how to make it, but how to store it. True, he had heard there were people in other lands who were starving, but it was their own fault. They were lazy, ignorant, shiftless, and undeserving. They hadn't mucked and grubbed and scraped like he had. They didn't deserve any better. No, sir. No, indeed. He wouldn't share his hard-earned goods with them folks. Grain, you know, must be kept in steel bins, not in hungry bellies. Then one day he looked over his auditor's report and income tax returns. He was quite pleased with the way things were going. He said to himself, "Sam, you old codger, you have enough to live it up the rest of your life. Put your land in the soil bank, man. Get a government loan on your grain, and then, boy, head for Florida. Sam, you're going to recline, dine, wine, and shine." And now watch this ending. Then God said to him, "You nitwit. On this very night, all these things are possessing your soul. You don't own them, they own you. And all this stuff you've piled up, whose is it really?" So the poor rich farmer was struck with a realization that he would continue for the rest of his life in bondage to the things that had enslaved him all along. "And that's the way it is," said Jesus, "with a man who sets his heart on money and not on God." And he makes a little comment at the end afterwards. He says, the point being made is that the farmer's riches are crying out for his soul. The traditional interpretation is that the man is going to die right away that night. Fate or God or some unnamed force is demanding his soul, saying that his time is up. But the Greek text doesn't exactly say that. It doesn't say, this night your soul is being demanded of you. It says, this night they require thy soul of thee. They, referring to the many good things which the farmer thought he owned. That's powerful, isn't it? These things are telling the farmer what to do, so that he can't do what is desired by God. He's trapped. He can't do what is desired by God, to whom the soul rightfully belongs. And I really wonder which is the worst. You know, which would be the worst? Does that make it any happier an ending to make it end that way? Makes it worse. It could be. Yeah, Bill?
It would give him a chance to get out.
It would give him a chance, possibly. Okay.
Sounds like a living death.
A living death? Okay. All right. What a way to go. I'm not sure I play. Okay. All right. Any further reactions to either the folks in Nicaragua or Clarence Jordan at this point? Anybody want the last word on here to share with us? Don't all speak at once.
Yeah. First man, he not only maybe had more money, but he had so many more worries. I don't think he's that much happier than myself right here. He's happy at all.
Okay, all right. Well, anyway, gives us something to think about, agonize over. I can't say I want you all to just have a fun time agonizing over it, but it's a tough one. Anyway, have a nice day. Thanks for coming.